Hello, my fellow Westorians. We are ready to begin our exciting new chapter? Series of chapters. Like 350-ish chapters, really. Welcome to Valar Rereadus. We should start back, is the first line of the series. And there's a lot of meta in that line, because George R. Martin was once asked if he would ever do an Atlas of Ice and Fire, something that a lot of different fiction writers have done, especially fantasy novelists. But George was pretty adamant that he would never do such a thing. He said, it's all in there. You just have to reread. Indeed, that is what we have to do. So we're going to. Now, of course, George did eventually write additional material outside of the novels, but it's still not a narrator, an all-seeing narrator who knows things. It's still all from the perspective of in-world characters. So I am really, really excited about this. Just starting to reread A Game of Thrones has just reminded me of what we're in for. Just the little details, finding so much in every sentence, and having so much to say about so much. Yeah, I can hardly contain myself. And this is, to be clear, this is an advanced class. If this were a university setting, this isn't for casual Song of Ice and Fire fans. This is a reread, not a read. It's not Valar Rereadus. It is Valar Rereadus. So anyone who's been with History of Westeros for a while, meaning been a listener or watchener, that already that we go deep into the details, but we haven't done anything like this specifically, actually delving straight into the material. It's a new look for us. And it's going to be so much fun. It's like a guided tour in a different sense. We're gonna do things our way. There's going to be a lot of detail gathering, of course. That's one of our favorite things to do. We're going to point out the historical tidbits. We're going to point out a lot of foreshadowing. It's going to be so awesome. We're reading the books together. That's just so great. No matter how else this falls out, that's going to be the best.
There'll be TV show spoilers, but there will also be the Winds of Winter spoilers, right?
That's right. Yes, we're also going to take into account the Winds of Winter. That will be to a pretty big minimum. We don't have a lot of reason to bring up all these Winds of Winter chapters frequently. The show stuff is going to be pretty hard not to take into account somewhat frequently. It doesn't mean we're going to delve into what the show did, but we are going to acknowledge what it did and compare it to what we might get in the books. You know, it's the journey, not the destination, right? Even if we know certain endgame points for certain major characters, how we're going to get there is still a huge mystery, and George writes it all so well. I'm not geeking out and re-falling in love with the Song of Ice and Fire over just these first few chapters because they're new to me. I know exactly what's happening in them, and I love reading them. So again, if you're like me at all in that regard, it doesn't matter much that some of these big endgame spoilers. And because our pace is going to be aggressive, we're not going to spend a lot of time on the well-known plots. In other words, we're not going to rehash the murder of Jon Arryn all that much. We're not going to ignore it either, but it's not going to be something we get really deep into the weeds on. However, counterexample, Bran. We're going to get very deep into the little symbolism and the very minutia details of Bran because we got some pretty huge revelations in the show about him and a lot of other characters too. And speaking of the show, another really important thing we're going to do is we're going to dispel show habits, things that we've all kind of forgotten because the show taught us wrong from the perspective of the books. Meaning, some things are kind of obvious, right? Like Tyrion's appearance. Tyrion's missing his nose, and he's not a handsome man like Peter Dinklage. That's one that we all kind of realize. That's not one's like, oh yeah, Tyrion. But there's sneakier ones like Bran looks like a Stark in the show, but in the books, he looks like a Tully. He's got red hair, auburn red hair, and blue eyes. Small thing, but it matters. And another good example there is no one forgot that the Targaryens have purple eyes, even though the show doesn't have that. But eye color does matter. We pay more attention to things like eye color. It has more meaning. And another example would be just certain characters, certain characterizations. Like Sandor Clegane is a perfect example. You know how many times in the show he says the C word, you know, the one that rhymes with hunt? A lot, right? How many times does he say it in the books? Big fat zero. Nothing. Never. It's not like he's not insulting or abrasive. He just isn't quite so vulgar, and he's more complex. He cries, right? This is different. He's a different character. I'm not complaining about the show Hound, but Book Hound is a different character, even though he has a lot in common with show Hound. And you can like them both, but recognize those differences. We're also going to be looking a lot at lines you missed, characterizations that have different meaning the second time around. For example, one we'll get to next time that people have been pointing out only in the last few years. Well, for the most part, there's certainly people who caught it probably way back in the day in the 90s. The line that Robert says when Ned is talking to him about kings in the north, and Robert says, "Oh, the kings and they're hiding under the snow, snow!" And he yells it basically, "Snow, kings hiding under snow." Hello, Jon Snow reference, right? That's a perfect example of the Valar rereader's concept too, and what George had in mind. And anyone who's been with us long enough knows that I love to hammer away on this point that George gives us the riddle to the question, or gives us the riddle to the answer to a riddle before he actually gives the riddle itself. One of those is coming up here in this very second chapter. I'll remind you all of it when we get to it. So by ignoring or giving less attention to the murder of John Arryn, to use that example again, and digging deeper into Bran's foreshadowing and John's foreshadowing and all this other stuff, it's more like we're looking at the third and fourth layers of the material and acknowledging the first two layers. If you want to use the onion analogy of a story having many layers, which does work pretty well, especially because of the Onion Knight, who we all love. And we'll also be talking about not just foreshadowing from HBO and The Winds of Winter, but Fire and Blood. I forgot to mention that before. Fire and Blood has a lot of relevance to A Song of Ice and Fire, new stuff. And we get to take all that into account, too. So we're taking into account HBO. We're taking into account Fire and Blood. We're taking into account The Winds of Winter. And we're taking into account just new theories that people have put out into the fandom. So many other things. If you can't tell already, even though I've said it already, I'm so excited. Another note about formatting here. It's going to be chapter, take questions. Chapter, take questions. Chapter, take questions. So it should be fairly organized and straightforward in that regard. So Shay is monitoring the chat for questions. If you're catching this after the fact, send them to us at westeroshistory@gmail.com or tweet them at us. It's Westeros History on Twitter. And of course, you can always go to the Facebook group, which I've already recommended. You may have the UK edition. You may be reading it on Kindle. You may be following along on Audible. So I'm going to give a couple of different ways every episode for y'all to make sure you're with us. Besides the posted schedule, which has the name of each chapter, there's also some links we've posted on these various sites where we're keeping Valar rereader's material. So make sure you get a hold of that if you're trying to follow along perfectly. And also, you don't have to follow the schedule. Read at your own pace. We're going to try to emphasize certain chapters and tell people that only certain chapters are more important, like the most important chapter out of each batch. Another thing we'll be doing in each episode is pointing out some of the famous lines, like in this prologue. We all love that line, "Dance with me then." It's just a great example of the way George writes, where he has this character that we're immediately predisposed to dislike. Waymar Royce is a little jerk. He's arrogant. He talks down to people who have experience. It's not much to like. But right away, he gives us this gray characterization of this guy who we don't really like. But he fought like Will says. In that moment, he was a boy no longer. He was a man of the Night's Watch.
I mean, it's epic.
It is epic, right?
And beautiful.
Yeah, it is really good. Oh, this is the kind of story we're in for now, huh? And it's terrifying. It's horror. That's something that gets me, is that I was a fantasy fan when I came to Game of Thrones. I wasn't really a horror fan. I would rate it low in terms of my favorite genres. That's changed a lot over the years. I read Game of Thrones a long time ago for the first time, and my opinions have changed over those preceding almost 20 years. But George R. R. Martin gets a lot of credit for that, because he mixed fantasy and horror. And of course, zombies and undead creatures are nothing new in fantasy. I've seen all that before. But George wrote it in a way that you really felt it. The terror was more palpable. He just does it better, frankly. Not than anyone. A good example is Lovecraft. Lovecraft writes fear extremely well, too. And there's no doubt George's influence from H.P. Lovecraft is in this first chapter. The theme of fear is overwhelming. But there's more to it than that, isn't there? There's themes of duty. Will's duty to warn Waymar is really important, but he's afraid to. And it didn't even matter. The other didn't sneak up on Waymar. Didn't stab him in the back. They had a face-to-face duel. So here's one of our first examples of breaking show habits. In the show, the others are portrayed a bit differently. The way they behave is similar, but the way they look, some things are very similar, some things are very not. The book version, they're beautiful, they're elegant, they're graceful. In the show, They're just like old guys that are move like young guys. They look ancient. They don't look beautiful. They do not look elegant. They look terrifying. Not that beautiful and elegant can't be terrifying, but they just went a different, they went a little more straightforward with the look for the show. And I can kind of understand that.
I mean, they look like decrepit in the, yeah. in the show.
They look.
I mean, they're ice zombies, which is very different.
With the wrinkles and.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. And I think maybe they.
They look straight out of Tales from the Crypt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It would be hard to make them elegant, too, right? That's just hard to pull off. Showing them walk on the snow without leaving tracks, that would have just been hard to pull off, I think. But so like this isn't a complaint. Whenever we point to show book differences, 9 times out of 10, it's not to complain, even though I might have a complaint. But that's not where I'm going with it. Just to remind us of the differences. That's the point here. And another important thing is originally they were going to have the others speak in the show. They even had David J. Peterson, who wrote the language for High Valyrian and Dothraki. They had him work up a Skroth, which is the White Walker language. They decided not to use it, though. But it's important for us, and it's important to know, and for us to key into these details since they weren't in the show. They speak, here's an example, here's a quote. The other said something in a language that Will did not know. His voice was like the cracking of ice on a winter lake, and the words were mocking. And later, there's a quote, far beneath him he heard their voices, and laughter sharp as icicles. So, they have a culture, they have language. They laugh. This is the reminder that they used to be people. And we know now, at least if the show is accurate, that they were made by the children of the forest. I imagine the making of them will vary. It probably won't be as simple as jamming a dragonglass shard into their heart. But dragonglass might be involved. After all, dragonglass does undo the others. And that may have been a feature that the children built in when they designed them. That's something that we still didn't really get much information on in the show. So that's still a mystery. And another thing that's described about them, George calls them like the Sidhe, which is a, I'm probably not saying that right, S-I-D-H-E. It's a Celtic word, and it refers to, it's like a whole thing of forest creatures, fairies. It's a whole Irish Celtic thing. And George had that in mind when he thought of how to describe them. One description he gave to an artist was that their armor reflects everything around them. And you see that as Will at first questions what he's seeing. He sees them coming, and then maybe it's part denial because he's afraid to admit that he just saw the others, but that also that they're so camouflaged that he wasn't even sure what he saw. A question that's asked about them a lot is whether the cold comes with them or if they come with the cold. And I think it's answered right in this first chapter. The line is written, Sir Waymar may have felt the cold that came with them, but he never saw them, never heard them. And that feels right to me as well. Later, Sir Waymar, before he actually sees the first other, he says he's yelling for Will to answer him and says, why is it so cold? He's getting frustrated, but it's also his fear speaking. And so the cold comes on right when the others arrive. So I kind of doubt that the others just knew that it was going to get cold and showed up right then. No, it seems that they bring the cold. It's not a chicken and an egg kind of question. It may seem that way to people south of the wall, but right here we get that answer. They bring it with them. And that makes sense in other ways, too. We've seen that. That also explains, for example, why those men froze, right? That's a big conundrum right here in this chapter. Will and Waymar argue about it. Waymar makes a good logical argument as to why the wildlings could not have frozen to death. The wall was weeping, right? He's got a point there. But that's logic that doesn't incorporate the magic of the others. So they did freeze to death. It was the cold of the others, as best as we can tell. They weren't chopped into bits like they were in the show. Another thing to remember, they were literally just not moving. When Will comes back to report what he saw, they're just sitting there frozen, even the person up in the tree. Yeah, that's magical cold. That's like what Waymar himself pointed out. These were healthy men with the means to make fire, and they didn't. But they weren't stabbed either. The only explanation is the cold, even though Waymar argues his party out of it, because without magic, it doesn't make sense. One theory that's out there is that from, it's been around a while. Joe Magician is the latest person to bring it up, and he had new takes on it. He's not recycling an old theory by any means. He has definitely new things to say about it, which is that the others may or may not be hunting for the prince that was promised, or Jon Snow, or maybe that's the same thing. And they may have thought that Waymar was that. And this, one of the reasons why people think that is because they pause and they take a look. Because he looks like a first man as well. He's of House Royce. He has the gray eyes. He looks a little bit like a Stark, but not really like a Stark, just like a first man. The Starks have a look, the first men have a look, and the Royces have a look. And there's similarity between all three of them. But they're not all the same thing. It's not, those aren't three statements that all say the same thing. They just all have some things in common, because they're all first men. And of course, the part of this notation is because they look at the sword. When Waymar and the other come together, the other pauses for a second to look at his sword. Whether the other thinks it's Lightbringer or Valyrian steel or whatever, it's an interesting moment where there's a moment of consideration by this thing that's clearly outmatching Waymar. But he still has this moment of caution, and that's very, very interesting. Another thing I want to point out is that there are six others in this spot here. Six of them. One that comes up to fight, and then the other five that stand and watch and don't interfere until Will is done, until he's got a shard of sword in his face and he's screaming and done, and they all come and chop him to bits. So there's six of them. And then in the next chapter, we get six direwolves. One apart from the other five. I don't know if that's intentional, but six isn't usually a number you see paired like that. You see threes and sevens and 12s and 13s and even numbers like 10 and 20 and 50. Six, not as much do you see that one. It might have been intentional. Definitely worth considering. Now, as in terms of their equipment, the sword itself, not Waymar's sword, but the other swords. Quote, no human metal had gone into the forging of that blade. It was alive with moonlight, translucent, a shard of crystal so thin that it seemed to vanish when seen edge on. There was a faint blue shimmer to the thing, a ghost light that played around its edges, and somehow Will knew it was sharper than any razor. Yeah, and George has also been quoted as saying that the others can do things with ice that humans have never conceived of. And that's what's going on with both their armor and then, and it's with its incredible reflective qualities and these razor-thin swords that can shatter real swords, castle-forged steel. Will remarks on how it's a really nice sword that Waymar has. And as they're fighting, Waymar's sword starts to pick up frost, which is really creepy when you think about it, because frost building up on something that's constantly being hammered into something else, like two blades ramming into each other. Frost doesn't collect on something that's being hammered like that. So much jostling and jolting. That's just showing you how cold it is, which is yet more evidence that the others bring the cold with them. That's magical cold happening right there on that sword. That is not natural. A couple of random notifications here that we picked up. Random notes. Like I said, we'd love to keep an eye on the historical tidbits. Of course, not a whole lot of that in this first chapter when George is just trying to give you the setting. You know, the first house mentioned is House Royce, though. That's cool. And Waymar's sword again comes up. The broken hilt is probably shows up in a Dance with Dragons many, many books later. When the wildlings are turning over their collected wealth to Jon so they can buy food with it, one of them turns in a sword with a broken blade that has jewels in the hilt. And that could be Waymar's sword because there's jewels in the hilt of his sword. And we know that the sword shattered. So, yeah, could be. Another interesting tidbit I caught here was the first mention of the word Ironwood. If you don't know the significance of Ironwood, well, there was that Telltale Games game that was set in Westeros. It was mostly a TV setting, but it had book and TV crossover stuff. It was a really solid game. It had voices by a lot of the real actors. There was Peter Dinklage and Natalie Dormer and other people.
Yeah, but House Forrester lived by the Ironwoods.
Yeah.
In the north.
And so a lot of people were wondering, hey, is Ironwood, is that a real thing? Are Ironwoods really in A Song of Ice and Fire? And is that a real house? Yes and yes. They certainly expanded on the Ironwood story for the game and made it a little more fantastical. But Ironwood absolutely is a thing. It's here in this first chapter. It's here in the second chapter. It's in the second chapter twice. Ironwood is mentioned about eight times in the first two books and then doesn't appear again until book five. It's mentioned only 12 times total.
Of course, it does make you wonder about Ironwood, the house in Dorne as well, which is spelled differently, if there's any relation at all.
Yeah, it does make you wonder. It definitely does. And in fact, the Ironwood stump is where Garrett is executed. And an Ironwood is up where the woman who froze to death up in the tree that Will was careful to not be seen by, that was an Ironwood as well. Now, there's also more coverage of this chapter in our Azeez versus A Game of Thrones prologue episode. And that was, of course, made years ago. So, of course, we didn't take into account King Bran or others and things like that. But we wouldn't have needed to. King Bran isn't relevant to the prologue. Bran's not in the prologue. But it's still worth it to check that out, even though it's not fully up to date. But it's mostly there. We haven't learned that much more about the others since then, right? There are six others, like I said, in this first scene. How many others are there in the entire rest of the books? Less than six. There's the one Sam faces. And there's certainly some others that are referenced. Fewer. Got me. Got me good. And yeah, so that's... I can't even talk. She got me too good. I'm speechless. The last line of the chapter is, they were gloved in the finest moleskin and sticky with blood, yet the touch was icy cold. So here in the first chapter, we get ice and blood instead of fire and blood. And you definitely get that horror feel, the horror chapter element with the way that chapter ends. Ho! This dude's being strangled to death by a zombie that just came out of nowhere. And, well, we're off, aren't we? That's the prologue.
Okay, anyways.
First questions here from the prologue from Stephanie the Peerless. Do you think it's significant that Will never mentioned seeing children at the Wildling encampment? I just wondered if the others could have taken them like they take Craster's children. I also think it's interesting that the other fought Waymar 1-1, but also that it seems like he could have shattered Waymar's sword at any time, but let Waymar fight until he was tired before this happened. It seems they have an honor code of some sort, and the big question, why do they all dip their swords in Waymar's blood after he dies? Any ideas? Okay, so one at a time. It is interesting. I don't think it's significant that there's no children there because they were raiders. They were chasing raiders, so I wouldn't expect this wildling group to have children. And maybe they do seem to have a code of honor, just fighting one at a time like that. They didn't stab him in the back. They easily could have. On the other hand, it's not really honorable if you know that this person is no contest, which it does seem to be. Like the other, it didn't really ever seem like there was a real fight. I think the other may have been toying with him. And as far as how the sword could break, I'm not sure that he could do it at any time. The cold may have been building up, but it may be just as you say, which would fit with what I just said about them toying with him. They were just like, oh, I'm going to play with you, toy a sword fight a little bit, and now we're done. I'm like breaking your sword and that's it. Yeah, something like that. As for dipping their swords in his blood, I don't know if there's anything magical to that. It could be, though, but it might be a cultural thing. A lot of warrior code type situations where you have the blood of your enemies as face paint, or you drink it, or you eat their heart, or something like that. Something kind of out there. But it does seem like they wanted to do it. Maybe just a way to add to the horror. I'm not sure. But it's a good question to keep an eye on. It might be something that we get an answer for later. It's one of those things we just haven't learned, even with the show and everything. We still don't really know that much about how the others work. It's one of these things that we still are very in the dark on. Craig Christian asks, if people haven't actually heard the cracking of ice on a lake, look for it on YouTube. It sounds like nothing like you'd think. Really eerie. Good call, Craig Christian. Yeah, that's a very good idea, because that is how the description of the other's voice sounds, like cracking of ice. And I imagine that once you hear that sound played for real, and then keep it in your mind when you're reading bits about the others, probably added the effect.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Let's move on to Bran 1. Bran 1, there's seven Bran chapters in A Game of Thrones, 21 total Bran chapters. This chapter has 9 pages in the U.S. paperback edition, 8 pages in the U.K. edition. So it's a little bit short, but not too short. The average chapter length in Game of Thrones is 10.9. The first line is, the morning had dawned clear and cold with a crispness that hinted at the end of summer, eh? Ninth year of summer is also said right away here in these opening chapters, or paragraphs rather, and it says that it's the seventh of Bran's life. So Bran has not experienced winter yet. Right away, we get one of these really awesome concepts that plays out much later in the books. It's delved into later in the books, but it's presented to us right here. Rob and Bran both think the person that's about to get executed is a wildling. He had lost both ears and finger to frostbite, and he dressed all in black, the same as a brother of the Night's Watch, except that his furs were ragged and greasy. So he is a brother of the Night's Watch. And yes, the same as a brother of the Night's Watch. A human being is a human being, no matter what side of the wall he or she is standing on. That's something that John learns very well later, that a lot of these stories, and these stories come right away here in this chapter. It's like fourth paragraph where Bran starts thinking about others consorting with ghouls and their women sleep with the others. This is all this over-the-top stuff that we know is not really true. There's a grain of truth to some of it, but most of it is not true. That facade is torn back and you realize, hey, the wildlings and the brothers of the Night's Watch are, they're all just people. And it's not explained that well here because it's not meant to be. It's an introduction to that concept. But we know, we're rereading. We see it right here in this first chapter. And bam, George got us into that right away. But that's nothing compared to what else is in this chapter. Whew. This was one of the first things I wanted to look at right after the revelation that Bran's going to be king. Because immediately, you think back to these early chapters. I remember, again, since I've been in the fandom so long, I remember when we all started going back and looking at all the, oh, let's look for foreshadowing of Bran becoming a greenseer. And it was there, here in this first chapter, but we mistook it. We thought it was greenseer foreshadowing, and it is. But it's also king foreshadowing. The two have a lot in common. It enables George to wrap one up in the other sneakily, because greenseers are powerful. It's a very powerful thing. And you look down on the world and see the little people doing their jobs, which is something that comes up in Bran 2. We'll talk about that more later. So it's all right here. It just starts right here, but it's not power necessarily here in this first chapter. That's not really discussed. It's rulership themes. The conflict of being a ruler and how difficult it is and how all these decisions really matter and what route you can take and what attitude you have to be a ruler and what kind of ruler you'll be. Boom, right? At the end of Game of Thrones, that fear versus love dichotomy of ruling is huge. And it's right here in this first chapter. Ned's justice, it seems fair, especially because it's couched in this personal judgment thing where the man who passes the sentence should swing the sword. That seems honorable, right? But we know there's a little more to it because we saw this dude run off from the others, something that Ned doesn't even entertain the possibility of in the next chapter with Catelyn. Catelyn says, is it the wildlings? And she says, she seems a little skeptical. And Ned's like, well, who else could it be? Well, we saw who it could be, the others. But why would Ned consider that? But there's also detachment. And that's an important aspect of considering duty and justice versus mercy. He had a grim cast to his gray eyes this day, and he seemed not at all the man who would sit before the fire in the evening and talk softly of the age of heroes and the children of the forest. He had taken off father's face, Bran thought, and donned the face of the Lord Stark of Winterfell. Yeah, and that comes up later, too. Rob starts to put on his brave, lordly face when they're arguing about keeping the direwolves alive later, which is meant to be, but not overtly expressed as, a dichotomy here. Meaning, the two different scenes are both execution scenes. It doesn't seem like execution for the direwolves because they're animals, and you don't think of animals as being executed. That's not usually the way we think of killing animals. But it's the same concept. You have duty to the realm. Ned points out that it's not as simple as being lost to fear. The deserter knows his life is forfeit if he is taken, so he will not flinch from any crime, no matter how vile. So, sure, we can have sympathy for this guy because he just saw an 8,000-year-old evil come back to life, and it may have literally magically affected his mind, as in it was supernatural magic in his head driving him to be so afraid, not just regular human fear. We're not clear. I'm not saying it's definitely what happened, but it's definitely possible. And how is that fair to execute a man for desertion when he's literally lost his mind. Is that fair? I don't know. It's probably not fair, but it still might be the right thing to do, because as Ned said, again, the deserter knows his life is forfeit and he will not flinch from any crime. So, yes, you can see the mercy angle here and say this guy is out of his own mind. He has no control. On the other hand, the fact that he's out of his mind is part of why you have to kill him, because he's a danger to others. And that dichotomy is still there with the direwolves. It's the same argument. Ned says, nah. They look cute now, but a full-grown direwolf is savage, terrifying, can rip an arm off someone's shoulder. Yet, no one speaks up for Garrett. There's no one around to love Garrett. His mind is gone. We don't even hear the dialogue. In the show, we hear him talk. But in the book, we don't. It's just words were exchanged, and Bran doesn't remember them, because from his perspective, they weren't terribly important. But the idea is that the man was hardly coherent. And it's super important. The eye, look in his eyes. This is another big dichotomy and big rulership theme. He had seen the ragged man's eyes, and he was thinking of them now. And then a little bit passes by, and Ned asks Bran. He sees that Bran is a little as thoughtful or maybe disturbed, and he knows it's his first time seeing justice done. And remember, the first part of the fear theme comes right away when Jon tells Bran not to look away. Don't be afraid. Make sure you watch. And then they're arguing about how it went. Rob says the man died bravely, but John says he was afraid. What do you think? His father asked. And this is so cool. Bran doesn't form his own opinion quickly. Even after his father asks, what do you think? He still doesn't answer. He asks another question. He says, can a man still be brave when he's afraid, or if he's afraid? That is the only time a man can be brave, his father told him. That seminal, awesome line. Such a great line, but it has so much more meaning now on reread, doesn't it? Because, well, just because that's the only time a man can be brave, well, it doesn't mean you can be brave in the face of fear. It doesn't mean there's other issues. So, it's super deep. Now, back to the fear versus love dichotomy. There's no one that loves Garrett. No one stands up for him. But Bran stands up for the direwolves. This is a good example of over-the-top symbolism hiding much more subtle themes. It's probably Bloodraven, right? Especially if you look at the map. We still haven't seen another direwolf in A Song of Ice and Fire. The only thing we hear, the only closeness we even get to that is Benjen mentioning that we sometimes hear them howling in the distance when we're ranging. That's it. That's the only other evidence of direwolves anywhere in the entire story. And yet, all of a sudden, each Stark just gets a badass wolf protector just right at the beginning of the story. Not only is there Bloodraven, it's meant to be over the top so the character can notice it. In the next chapter, Catelyn says, wait, antler? Wolf throat? Robert Baratheon? Stag? Wolf? Us? Coming north? Hello? But she doesn't say anything. Not that it would have necessarily mattered if she had, but it's interesting. So, another thing that Bran learns, and this is super important again, because this whole chapter, again, fear versus love, mercy versus duty and justice, Bran's being taught these lessons. And that's a huge difference because we know, or not just a huge difference, it's telling because we know that Rob got the same lessons and Jon, because they're older than Bran. But Dany, who we're going to get to next week, she doesn't get any of this. In her initial arc, we see she's just abused by her brother and lied to by Illyrio and sold to, and even in there she's observant, notices all these lies. But she's, no one teaches her about mercy and duty and justice. Most of what she ever learns about all that is completely self-taught, completely within her, and that's really cool. But it shows you that, well, Bran had a better head start on this. He got a good father to teach him all this stuff in an environment over time where he could think about it and ask questions and get good, respectable answers from someone who knows what's going on. Someone that's not going to lie to him. Someone that might, someone who isn't perfect. Dad's not perfect. Not all of his advice is perfect. But contrast to Dany, where people are just constantly lying and scheming. She doesn't have any reason to trust just about any of them, especially the guy most in charge of her well-being immediately, Viserys, who is clearly not looking out for her good. Whereas Bran has this wonderful family that's protective, that's looking after him. His brothers are teaching him. His John is looking out for him. Ned comes up to him right after and asks him, hey, Bran, how you doing? How is it? How does it How is it seeing your first man killed? What was that like for you? Talking through it, where Dany is just, people are killed at her wedding. What the hell is going on here? It's very different. It's very, very different. So all these lessons, one important part of the lesson here, I'm going to quote, if you would take a man's life, you owe it to him to look into his eyes and hear his final words. And if you cannot bear to do that, then perhaps the man does not deserve to die. He's just given that lesson, and then they cross the bridge. By the way, the bridge has ironwood planks, so it's symbolic. They cross the bridge from the execution to the other side, and here are these direwolves. Immediately a test of mercy versus duty. So again, I'll repeat that Ned says deserters are dangerous. You get that repetition here in the theme that clearly direwolves are dangerous too. And they're foreign to the realm too, aren't they? Now think about that lesson for a burgeoning king, the kind of conflict that a king would have, or a queen, any ruler would have. When you have a realm, when you have foreigners, innocent, helpless foreigners that are in your realm, not doing any harm, but that people are scared of. And so that alone can cause problems. It's not their fault, but it's still something that has to be dealt with because people are scared of them. Xenophobia, whatever you want to, whatever word you want to use, racism, prejudice, it's something that a ruler has to deal with. And that's a tough thing to deal with, right? Imagine much later down the story when a lot of new people are going to come to Westeros, Dothraki, Unsullied, R'hllorists, just people from Essos of all kinds, the Golden Company, some of whom are from places besides Westeros, and we're certainly not raised there. What's going to happen? That's going to be a test for any king or queen or ruler to how to deal with your own people's racism and the racism of foreigners potentially as well. It implies that if you're willing to move somewhere where you're not the minority race, you're not the majority race, that you're not as scared or that you aren't racist. But still, these things come up, and that's and here comes the fear theme in all of that. A big reason people fear foreigners is because they're strange and unknown. And the fear of the unknown is one of the most deep-seated types of fears that human beings have. And look at this revisionist attitude from some of these characters. Hullin, who is the master of horse, says, it'd be a mercy to kill them. A mercy to kill them. What? Why? Why would it be a mercy to kill them? It might be a mercy to other people. Like Ned said, if they're allowed to grow big and full size, they could just kill people. But that's still not a mercy to them. Bran looked to his lord father for rescue, but only got a frown, a furrowed brow. Hullin speaks truly, son. Better a swift death than a hard one from cold and starvation. Okay, so that's a better argument, starvation. But Are they gonna starve? I guess so, because they're wolf pups that haven't even opened their eyes. Their mother can't take care of them. But the fear is everywhere, and Bran is aware of it. Here's the line. Even Bran could sense their fear, though he did not understand. And because that's why he doesn't understand why they're afraid of puppies. His childlike attitude is kind of correct. He hasn't learned these fears that these other men have that really aren't justified. Born with the dead is one line he hears, because They may have been whelped after the wolf died. They may have come forth. And that, to the superstitious people, is a bad sign. It's a bad omen. So they're trying to justify killing these little animals by using superstition and fear. But superstition cuts both ways, doesn't it? And what is a greater duty to the realm than a duty to the gods? That's the one thing that can trump your duty to the realm, which is what Ned thinks of. First of all, duty is really important to him. But when John brings up the point that there's exactly 3 male direwolves and 2 female direwolves, and those exactly match his kids and exactly match the gender of those kids, Bran saw his father's face change, saw the other men exchange glances. He loved John with all his heart at that moment. Even at 7, Bran understood what his brother had done. The count had come right only because John had omitted himself. When have we recently seen John omit himself from something he had a right to? I'm not exactly sure this is foreshadowing for that, but it's definitely stuck out to me as a possibility because John had omitted himself.
Can I say 2 things?
Yeah, absolutely. One, say more than 2 if you like.
Debbie_Dane said, another mother dying around birthing.
So many. Yeah, you're right. Didn't even think of the direwolf. You're right. Danny's mom, yeah. Tyrion's mom, John's mom, and the direwolf mom.
Yes, and the direwolf mom. So that really cracked me up. But also with the genders of the sex of the different direwolves. Who checked him?
Yeah, they were able to tell pretty quickly. I guess the Master of Hounds was there right away. He just knew.
Maybe he checked him. I was just wondering who of the group was doing that. Anyways, that was very minor.
Very true. So Bran's thoughts on John go beyond this too. And I want to point out the love theme here. He loved John for doing that. And of course, Bran's main motivation here is that he immediately loved these puppies and immediately thought they deserved mercy and did not see the logic behind killing them. Even though he didn't necessarily have the experience to have seen that logic, he didn't agree with his father on it. And well, we know what happens. And there's another great little answer before the riddle moment here. It's one of my favorite examples to just of this concept. I know I've said it before in the podcast, but probably not recently. Maybe I have. It bears repeating, though. Okay, so after they've gone back across, they're crossing this bridge, they're halfway across, and no one can hear anything. But John stops and says, "Hey, do you hear that?" And Bran specifically stops and listens, and you get the description of what he hears. He hears the brook and the wind and nothing. He doesn't hear anything. And John goes back and gets Ghost. Comes back, he's like, aha, I found this one. And Bran thought it curious that this pup alone would have opened his eyes while the others were still blind. Earlier in the chapter, Bran sings to himself, John's eyes were a gray so dark they seemed almost black, but there was little they did not see. So there's your connection already. You've got John, who is more observant than his rest of his family, which is explained in his first chapter. And it's because he's a bastard, because he's left out of things more often, so he has to pay more attention, and he's looking from the outside more often. He's put in the observer position more often. But it's the same, it's that concept of opening his eyes sooner. The other thing that John says in his first chapter is that bastards grow up faster. Well, here you go. Ghost opened his eyes first, growing up faster. Boom. But the real trick here is that John heard Ghost, which is, as we know, he didn't hear Ghost. He did not hear Ghost. No one hears Ghost. Ghost never makes a sound. That is, we only know that because we have 5 books of evidence of Ghost never making a sound. You don't know that right away. You can't have, oh, look at that white wolf. He must never make a sound. How would you possibly know that? Because he's white and has red eyes. He clearly never makes a sound. And so there's no way for you to know that here. It's no way to catch that John wasn't hearing the wolf. It was in his head. It was the skin changer bond. It may have been Bloodraven may have been like, whoa, hey, y'all forgot one. And he sent a little, I don't know, brain email to John, however that works. Just sent a little message that, hey, well, hold on. Bark, bark, woof, woof. Don't you hear that? Go back. And there we go. Very cool. And of course, the last line of the chapter is, or last 2 lines, really, or 3 lines, is Jon Snow gave his father's ward a long, chilling look. I think not, Greyjoy, he said. This one belongs to me. And that's in response to Theon saying, this one will die even sooner than the others. And of course, right away, we see what a little jerk Theon is and how people don't like him. So we know we're not meant to like him, and we can judge that for ourselves. But other tidbits here. As I pointed out earlier, there's differences in the way the characters look from book to show. And in some cases, and in fact, most cases, it doesn't really matter that much, but it's still interesting to point out too. Rob in the books is thick and auburn-haired and blue-eyed, strong and fast.
Is that thick with 2 C's?
Yes, that is thick with 2 C's. Okay. Whereas John is slender, graceful, and quick. In the show, they're both kind of slender, graceful, and quick. You actually don't ever see Rob fight, but he's slender and graceful and maybe he's quick, but he's definitely not thick, nor auburn-haired, nor blue-eyed. And he doesn't even look that strong. Well, he looks, like I said, looks like slender and graceful, like more like John. So they're kind of opposites, but it's this fast, quick dichotomy. And you see it play out right away because they race. They go off into a race. They say, race to the bridge, and John gets the head start because he's quick. But Rob finds the direwolves first, which may indicate he actually won the race. Anyway, he certainly crossed that bridge first in the metaphorical death sense, and he did die before John, assuming John comes back. And we get the same dichotomy comes up in Fire and Blood as well, with, what is it, Aemon and Balon. One of them is strong and fast, and the other is quick and slender and graceful, etc. So it's kind of repeated. in Fire and Blood. We have a sword called Ice, this huge great sword called Ice that we're told is Valyrian steel. At this point, we don't really know what Valyrian steel is yet. We get a little more info in Kat's chapter, but we just know it's this big, fancy, huge. I said big already, but it needs to be said twice because it's really, really quite large. It's what he does the execution with, and it's neat that it's called Ice, which we've just seen these other swords, which I don't know if the others name their swords, but they're more like ice than this one is. This is more like frozen fire. It's Valyrian steel forged in the super heated flames of, however they do it, with dragon fire and spells and such, and sacrifice. How about that? And I also wanted to do something just a simple, little bit of map looking. We're not going to actually look at the map necessarily, but just you can look at it on your own. Just look how far the wall is to Winterfell. And this execution was played out. They rode there, did it, and came back. So it wasn't that far from Winterfell. It was a day's journey at most. Like, I don't even think it got nighttime during that. So unless Garrod was brought south for execution by a different lord, which is entirely possible, he fled. He got pretty far before he got caught, it seems. Same goes for the mother direwolf. That direwolf was really far south, right? They were like, wow, a direwolf south of the wall. But really, it's more than that. It's direwolf south of the wall all the way down here. Winterfall is not close to the wall. Remember how long it takes Jon and Tyrion to go there after the feast and all that, after Jon decides to go there. That's a pretty big deal. So, let's take a few questions. Talking about the first line of the chapter, abort consciousness. That's the username here, I assume. That's the line Martin wanted to write down when he started, I believe, if someone hasn't mentioned that already. Yes, yes, the first line of the chapter. Yeah, that's a good little meta here. It's the first scene George ever imagined. He had been on Hadrian's Wall and thought about the wall and the brothers or the Roman legionaries who must have been gazing into that dark north and wondering what was out there. And it inspired him. But he also had this moment where he imagined this execution scene in the snow, and it was from Bran's perspective. And that was the first chapter of A Song of Ice and Fire that they got an idea for. Originally, it was going to be a short story, but of course, it became a trilogy. Now it's 7, maybe. We'll see. So that's very cool. He managed to keep that original seed in his first chapter. And that's something that's going to come up a lot, too, by the way, as an aside. Some of George's original plans popping up in these early chapters, and some of them are false lights now. False foreshadowing. They do not apply anymore. But none of those are here that I can see. They are coming. Question here is, are Ironwoods like Weirwoods? The stump drank the blood eagerly, it says. That's a quote. Do you think we'll see Bran pass a sentence and swing the sword? We've seen Robb and Jon do it. Arya has her kill list and does this later in books. I suppose Sansa might have something to do with Littlefinger's death, and I'm not sure Rickon will live long enough, but since we learn about this first man tradition from Ned and Bran's chapter, I just wonder if there's a chance we might see Bran do this. It'd be kind of hard for him to swing the sword himself if he's crippled. He isn't even learning to use one, but maybe Hodor is still alive and can do that? I kind of doubt it. I kind of think Hodor is not going to survive beyond the wall. The show kind of taught us that. It may be true, maybe he dies some other way, but we're definitely getting a hold the door chapter or scene at some point, and that's probably not in the tree. There's probably not a door in the tree, even though the phrasing is used that there's a doorway, but it's a doorway, not a door. So we'll see about that. So I doubt that Bran will be able to swing the sword himself, which is an interesting kind of stepping back from what he was taught. On the other hand, if he's king of Westeros, he can't just rule like a northerner. He's got to rule collectively. He's got to take into account northern attitudes and southern attitudes, which, by the way, that's part of why it's important that he has blue eyes and red hair. It's a reminder that he's got half Tully blood. He is a mix of north and south. It's him as well as perhaps what he will be. And I like the color symbolism there, too. Let's just say this is tinfoil-ish, not because it's not supported, but because it's just one guess out of many possibilities. Let's say King's Landing is entirely annihilated, blows up, burns down, whatever. Whether or not the Iron Throne is still there, separate question perhaps, but where do you set up as a king if there's no more capital? Do you build, maybe Bran ends up Isle of Faces or in Harrenhal near the Isle of Faces. Well, then there's your color symbolism. The three colors of the trident, red, blue, and green. So Bran could be a green seer king with blue eyes and red hair sitting there at the fort near where the trident empties out into the sea. So That could be intentional. It could just be the colors line up nicely by accident. Up to y'all to decide on your own. Interpret it how you will. From Devi Dane, maybe Bloodraven didn't want Bran to go south. From Brian Eidolon, hey there, Brian. Shout out to Westeros, an American musical. He wrote, he and his some friends rewrote Hamilton for A Song of Ice and Fire. You can find it online. We attended in person at Ice and Fire Con, and it was so good. We laughed, we cried, and I'm not exaggerating. He says, Brian does, that Brian is both Stark and Tully. His is the Song of Ice and Melted Ice. Yes, yes. Not exactly fire in there. The hair is kind of a stretch. It's just red hair. They don't even call him Kissed by Fire because it's auburn. It's not really full red, but it's reddish. So Devi Dane says maybe Bloodraven didn't want Bran to go south. This is another thing that really is blowing up in my mind over the past few months. The dichotomy in the way we just saw. What we just saw in Bran's chapter is that he's more of a love and mercy kind of guy. That's what we can expect from him as a ruler, I think, if this first chapter is any indication. And I think it is. But Bloodraven is so much not. Bloodraven is a ends justify the means guy. He's a killing people to create peace is totally justified. He has a much different attitude towards ruling than Bran does. And that's going to be interesting if they clash on these things. Bloodraven is not the kind of mentor that Ned was. And I don't mean that because he's 125 years old and magical. That's a different kind of mentoring. That's obvious. I just mean their attitudes towards these things. Bloodraven wasn't really an honorable guy. That doesn't mean he was a bad guy. That doesn't mean he wasn't a good guy. I think he was overall had his mind on justice and duty and protecting the realm. But there's definitely some criticisms to be laid at his feet for how he went about doing that. And if he and Bran don't agree on a lot of these things, I really wonder how that could break out. Could they disagree? Could we get to the point where some of these tinfoil theories about Bloodraven trying to body snatch Bran, could that be true? Maybe. Problem with that theory is I think his Bran is clearly more powerful than Bloodraven, even though he's not experiencing his powers. I don't think Bloodraven can do that. I don't think he has that capacity. But I could be wrong, and if not, well, I won't be surprised. If I am, rather, I won't be surprised because this theory's been put out there already. What's coming up? I'm always going to try to give you guys a little bit of head start on what's coming. I want to tell you what to look for. So when you're reading the next set of chapters, you have some things in mind to be paying attention to. So you don't just catch it here on the podcast afterwards. That way, if you know what to look for ahead of time, you may have more questions for us and more engagement. Also, it's just more fun to have me tour guide for you a little bit and tell you what to look for. And a lot of you guys are going to pop in with things to point out as well. Once y'all get in this pattern that we're setting out here, once everybody gets used to this format of Valar Re-Readus, y'all will start contributing more as well. And I'm really looking forward to that because that's really a big part of the fun. Doing this as a group is more fun than us just sitting down and telling you what we think of every chapter, which is a totally fine way to do it. But that's part of why we're doing it differently, is we really like the interaction. But again, we don't want too much interaction, like we said at the beginning. That's why these live streams are semi-private. Spencer Morgan asks, interesting show versus book difference. In the show, we are led to believe that Will, the young scared Night's Watchman, is the one who runs away. But in the book, it is Garrod, the 40-year veteran. Yeah, I thought that was... I was slightly critical of that. I don't think it mattered a whole lot. But it does mean more for the 40-year-old veteran to run away. That's more terrifying, that he's scared. The 3-year veteran running off is just less scary than the 40-year-old veteran running off. When a guy who's seen it all, who's lost his ears to frostbite, who's lost toes and fingers, when that guy runs off, something's up. And of course, we learn later from Mormont that he's not the first. And in fact, we learn that in the next chapter from Catelyn. Ned tells Catelyn that he's the fourth one this year. And I'll have more thoughts on that in the next episode, because I think there's more to be said about that. It's not just random. Violent Messiah 666 says, what do you think Garrod actually saw? I don't know if he saw anything. We're told that the wildling camp was about 2 miles from where they tied their horses up. So Garrod may not have seen anything. He may have, though. He may have actually seen the others, and they spooked him, and he ran off. And that's part of what I want to get into next time, is whether or not they did it on purpose, whether they let him go, which I think, yes. I lean towards yes. They wanted him to run off. They wanted him to spread that fear in the south, destabilize the watch a little bit, put fear into the realm. So he may have seen him. He may have actually seen them, but he was terrified before the scene broke out, before the others appeared, before we saw the way the POV almost shifts. It's almost a shift. It's not quite a shift when Will says the others made no sound, because he does see them, but he just immediately is like, wow, they don't make a sound. It blows his mind in a scary kind of way. It's not quite like Victarion's chapter, where it completely changes from his perspective, and all of a sudden you're seeing, like, almost from a narrator perspective for about three paragraphs. It's not quite like that, but that one line is similar to that, where it's describing the others made no sound. That's almost a narrator thing to say. But Will is astonished that they make no sound. He's aware of it, that they're making no sound. So it's just a way to... It's just a line that's really scary. The others made no sound. You don't even know what they are yet. That's the first time they're named. Woo! The next question is from also from Bork Consciousness. If he had the ability, why didn't other three-eyed raven do it before him? Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, good point. Why didn't they? Yeah, see, I think that there's a lot of good arguments against this body-snatching theory. The fact that it hasn't happened before, and the fact that Blood Raven doesn't even hardly think it's possible. He doesn't think that going into Hodor is... I mean, he doesn't think it's impossible. He doesn't have the power to do it himself, apparently. And we saw that Varamyr Sixskins, very, very powerful warg himself, also didn't have the power to do it. Anyway, from Brian Eidolon again. Aziz, do you think there's any particular significance to Bloodraven and Ghost both being albinos? Are there any others in A Song of Ice and Fire? Yeah. Yes, I do think it's significant. I think it's an absolute call back to the Weirwoods themselves. They're described similarly with the red eyes and the white fur, but also we have Melisandre. And the Ghost of High Heart. Boom. Yep, that's next on the list. And I think there might be a couple others, but those are the main ones, definitely. Pale skin, red eyes. And Melisandre is particularly interesting because you're like, wait, what does she have to do with the old gods? What does she have to do with any of that? I guess we'll find out. She doesn't have to have anything to do with the old gods to have that coloring mean some of the same things. Bone and blood, because, yeah, it's weirwood. But beyond that, it's bone and blood. And that's Melisandre. You can see where that would apply
to her. I think it also gets into what we've theorized about with terms of the gods being a thing versus old gods, that they're tapping into this power and that her power is a real power that is
maybe gods are working, the best word we have for it.
Yeah, the best word we have for it, but that her worshiping R'hllor and tapping into that power can be very similar to them tapping into some magic system.
Yeah.
Which we talked a lot about in our religion and magic series, which some of our thoughts there would be different based on how the show approached things. But a lot of it's still the same, I think.
Yeah. From Anything Digital, is Sean doing these rereads? Sean is ahead of us. We'll probably catch him because he doesn't read super fast. And I do intend on maybe inviting him in for an episode or two, but we probably can't do a lot of that. This timing doesn't work great for him. And if we're trying to move quickly, having another person weigh in isn't going to help us do that necessarily. From Sally Nicholson, she says, in appreciation for the book club, I love how you were organizing this. Thanks for your hard work in making this content. Well, you know what? It is a labor of love. It is work, but it's fun to do. I'm really happy and really privileged to be able to do this. And yeah, it's part of why it's so exciting. But even without that, the books are just so good. It's so fun to reread them. Scott Wortman. Hey there. Scott says House Forester is mentioned in Dance as well. Okay, good. I did not realize that. Good to know. I imagine there's not a whole lot of detail on them, but that's cool. Yeah, they're definitely in there. I believe their keep is positioned at the top, like the northern tip of the Wolf's Wood. But that's from memory. I could be wrong. Here's what's coming up next time. This episode, of course, this particular live stream isn't our normal full length, but doing more chapters, they're going to be longer. Just not this time. So coming up next, Catelyn 1, Daenerys 1, Eddard 1, Jon 1, Catelyn 2, Arya 1, and Bran 2. The first line is, Catelyn had never liked this godswood. That's Catelyn 1. And the last line of Bran 2 is, crows circled the broken tower, waiting for corn. So if you get to that line, you've reached the end of our scheduled 7 chapters. Again, that's crows circled the broken tower, waiting for corn, which you can remember pretty easily because it's right after Bran gets tossed by the Kingslayer. The Kingslayer tosses future King Bran. Hey, that's meaningful, isn't it? Oh, yeah. We'll be talking about that quite a bit. So here's some things to look out for. My tour guide voice, always pay attention to the first line of a character's point of view. Very often there's clues as to their entire arc or for what George is trying to tell us about this character. And of the 7 chapters next week, 5 of them are firsts. Again, that's Catelyn's first and second. Arya's first, Eddard's first, Daenerys is first, and that's it. 5 of them, yeah. And also take note of immediately how important Catelyn is to our window to someone who's not from the North. All our other characters, besides Tyrion, who we know isn't from the North, but someone who lives in the North that's not from there. So Catelyn is her distrust of the Godswood, of Beyond the Wall, her fear of Beyond the Wall, her just strangeness of the North. It's supposed to be meaningful because she's not from there, where everyone, like, Bran's used to it. Rickon's grown up there. All these, even Sansa, who identifies more with the South, isn't as put off by this Northern stuff because she's used to it. She's born there. We also have Ned's continued thoughts on Garrod, and Manch Raider gets mentioned. The wildlings get talked about more, and also his denial that the others could possibly be a part of this, which, you know, can't blame him for thinking that. They hadn't been seen for 8,000 years. That's an unfathomable amount of time to human beings, really. We get John and Danny both being very observant for their age, very observant, super important there. And as I said, while Bran was being taught justice and fear and learning about mercy and duty and all the ins and outs of that, Dany is surrounded by fear and taught vengeance. She's taught by her brother, who is just this paranoid, cruel, vindictive, just bad guy, really. That's your father figure and your brother figure and your future husband. What kind of weird situation to be in, whereas compare that to Bran, who gets this nice fatherly upbringing, mother and father, whole family, all that. Of course, that falls apart later, but it's at least he gets that start. Then we get Eddard's first thoughts on the promise. It's already sneaky. The way that first sentence referring to Lyanna's promise is couched, it's almost something very mundane. It seems like, oh, I promise to bury her in the North. That's the way it's framed in this first time. So be aware of all the tricks George is trying to use to keep you off the scent, which, of course, we already know what the scent is. But it's neat to look at how he does that. And notice the transition from Eddard feeling crushed by duty as soon as he knows it's coming. He knows he doesn't want it. He knows it's a bad idea. But he knows he has no choice but to accept being Hand of the King to his friend Robert, who's openly admitting that, yeah, I'm going to drink and sleep my way into an early grave, take care of my feces. And that segues immediately to John's first chapter. You have Ned feeling down about that duty situation to John being temporarily relieved that he's a bastard. He's like, most times I hate being a bastard, but this is one of the few times it's good. And why is it good? Because no one's paying any attention to him. Everyone's leaving him alone. Think about how that sticks out for John's ending in the show. Everyone's leaving me alone. No one's paying attention to me. I like that. Yeah. And for Bran's chapter, biggest of all, consider how his climbing and looking down on the world feels like Greenseer foreshadowing, but it's hiding that king foreshadowing. Both a king and a Greenseer wield massive power of different kinds, but Bran may end up being both, and that's huge. And consider, too, the foreshadowing and symbolism, not the foreshadowing, but the symbolism of him climbing high, which is chaos is a ladder. All the different similes and ways that power is said as something that's high, like a tall thing. You climb up, you ascend to heights of power. It's always couched in height and tallness and all that stuff. So when Bran is looking down on the world as he's climbing, he sees all these little people doing their little jobs. It seems like green fear foreshadowing, but think of it as king foreshadowing. Consider it in a different light, especially when the Kingslayer tosses him down from those heights of power, only to give him new powers and to rise up again much later. And there's a lot of irony there, especially if you consider the original plan George R. R. Martin had. His original trilogy plan was for Jaime Lannister to murder his way to the throne and blame it on other people, particularly Tyrion, if I recall correctly. He didn't love his brother in the original plan. He was totally willing to throw his brother under the Valyrian steel bus. What's a bus? Under the Orcs?
I did want to point out someone in the chat who notes something that I forgot. Will Moss says chaos is a ladder isn't said in the books.
It's not. You're right.
It's worth noting.
It's true. And I use that. In fact, I don't know of a similar line in the books, but the concept is there. So that's why I borrowed the show line, because it actually is a pretty good invention by the show there. Chaos is like, you know, it'd be funny if we find out that George wrote that episode, because he did write episodes back then.
Yeah, he did write
that. Maybe he wrote that episode. That'll be hilarious. Like, oh, nope, can't give the show owners credit for that. That's George also. But maybe not. Probably not. Probably they wrote that one. Because he only wrote one episode a year, so it would have to be that one particular one. So it's really big in that sense. And there's just so much to consider. And then, so be aware of all that. Be aware of these language that he uses, heights and being above, and how that's symbolism for power. And consider also all these things in this first chapter about how he views duty and justice and mercy and love and all that. And see how that continues to play out. Because he's not done with the king foreshadowing in this first chapter. From Hi, Hello, Emma. What do you think of that? The first few times we are acquainted to Valyrian steel are Beyond the Wall and Winterfell. I think I'm reaching with something, but I think it's interesting. Well, everything we see is Beyond the Wall, is the beginning is Beyond the Wall and Winterfell. But, and it's interesting too that Catelyn is the one who describes the ice in her chapter more than we get elsewhere. But it is neat that there's extra Valyrian steel in the north. Like, how House Mormont got a Valyrian steel blade is something that a lot of people wonder about. Like, they're poor. And so it's interesting to think, what could they have done to earn that? It probably didn't buy it, right? Because they're so poor, they probably earned it somehow. But how? I got no idea. Well, maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll get more history on Longclaw. That's another one I wondered. Will John keep Longclaw the whole run of the books like he did in the show? Good question. Lots of little questions like that we can't possibly think of all the different things. Like, will this happen? Will that happen? That's what you guys are here to help with. We'll think of a lot of it, and you guys cover whatever we miss, and we'll debate and discuss all of it. But that, I believe, covers today. And, well, it's in this first next chapter. Catelyn tells Ned in her first chapter that Jon Arryn's dead. So that's why I keep using that example, because it comes up a lot, and we're about to hit it. But it's also a good example of a chapter of a type of plot line that we don't really need to focus too much time on. Instead, we look for the deeper clues, the magic, the foreshadowing, the endgame stuff, the character conflicts, all the fun stuff that we didn't catch the first time through, that we didn't know about because the show hadn't revealed some of these things. Oh boy, do we have a lot to do, and I'm so excited.
And Jennifer Shanley Clark checked for us, and the climb was written by the showrunners.
Okay.
So they did write that line.
Okay, well, good job, showrunners. That's a good line. It's called The Climb, really?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
They really did. They were pretty good at fitting themes into episodes like that.
Yeah.
So, cool. All right, then. That's it for everybody today. Thank you to Ashea for running production and managing the chat. Thank you to everybody who attended live.
Special, special thank you to Michael Klarfeld at claradox.de, who made a new little Valar Reredus animation for us with a little bit of music. And the music is by
Kevin MacLeod.
MacLeod.
But yes, thank you to Michael. Absolutely good catch there, Ashea. Thank you to Michael. Hugely awesome that you did that for us. Of course, he made our regular video intro too. So this is just our intro and map guy. It's amazing. We couldn't possibly have found a better person to do these things. And he is so generous. So thank you very much, Michael. And thank you to Kevin as well for the music. That's really good. It fits perfectly. And thank you to Jennifer for looking that up about the climb. All good. So I've been saying it forever, but now it's fits. It's not just a thing I say anymore. It's now a series that we're doing. It's a thing instead of just a phrase I use. So for real this time, Valar Reredus.